Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So you may not realize it, but the legacy of Barry Goldwater is present in this year's presidential race. John McCain holds the Senate seat that Goldwater had from Arizona. Goldwater went from being a supporter of McCain to having an icy relationship with him back in the 90s. We'll talk about that. Hillary Clinton started her political life as what they called a Goldwater girl in 1964, the year that Barry Goldwater ran for president. Now, a collection of Barry Goldwater's diaries and other writings has been published by his son, former Congressman Barry Goldwater Jr., and by former White House counsel John Dean. It is called Pure Goldwater. It reveals the thinking of the conservative icon in everything from a letter to Thomas Edison when Goldwater was a 14-year-old electricity buff to his disillusionment with the Republican right's hold on American conservatism shortly before his death in 1998. So it is my pleasure to welcome John Dean back to WNYC and Barry Goldwater Jr. to our studios. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
And let me start right in with Goldwater and John McCain. John Dean, when Goldwater was retiring from the Senate in 1986, how much was McCain his hand-picked successor?
Well, I think clearly he was willing to assist, and when I really parse the material, when I look at some of the surrounding correspondence, we put some of it in the book, I think that there's no question that Jack McCain, who was John McCain's father and an admiral, was very close to the senator. And that might have influenced his decision to help a young Arizona congressman who was just learning the state to get his very cherished seat. But anyway, McCain did get the senator's help in fundraising, but the relationship would sour.
And Mr. Goldwater, was your father a mentor to John McCain? Did you know McCain before he was in the Senate? And was he close to your father, kind of studying at his feet in any way?
I don't believe so. My father was a mentor to him, certainly. All the veteran politicians, Udall, Senator Hayden, were all mentors to John McCain because he was new to politics and new to the state. But I think they worked together. They had a working relationship. I don't think it was a close one, but I think it was a civil relationship.
But as I gather from the book, your father got turned off to Senator McCain after the so-called Keating 5 scandal. What happened there to disillusion your father?
You know, I don't know. John probably has a little better insight into that.
Well, I think I might. For listeners who have forgotten about the Keating Five, they were five members of the U.S. Senate who had varying degrees of connection with Charles Keating, who was a savings and loan mogul based in Arizona and California as well. But he contributed heavily to the McCain campaign. And when he got in trouble with the federal regulators, McCain was one of those involved in blocking the investigation by the federal regulators into the what became sort of the symbol of everything that went wrong with the SNL debacle. And it hurt McCain badly. He did not get censured by the Senate. He did get scolded by the Senate. He got his wrist slapped. But what happened after that, it did hurt him. And when he was running for reelection in 92, rather than really clearing it with the senator as thoroughly as he should, he started using Senator Goldwater's name for fundraising purposes. And some of the senator's friends tipped him off that McCain was putting together a salute for Barry Goldwater, which was really a salute for John McCain to raise some money. Mm-hmm. And the senator pulled him up short.
Really. Now, most accounts of the Keating 5 scandal have McCain as a very minor player who never did take bribes from Charles Keating or do him any favors, even though he met with him. I don't know if you've looked into this, John Dean, but maybe Goldwater didn't come to believe that McCain had acted honorably enough, even though he's now seen as, I think, maybe by far the most minor of those five senators.
I think he was the most minor of the five senators. I've heard some friends who worked for DeConcini at the time who grumbled about McCain getting somewhat skating through a little bit more easily than he should have. But there's no question that he tarnished his name, he tarnished the state, and it troubled the senator that he was being manipulated and being used to raise money when without really seeking the blessings and
trouble Mr. Goldwater.
It troubled him deeply.
That McCain Brian, was using
if
his
I,
name
if
that
I
way.
Can just interject here, it's real easy to look upon everyone's falling downs. But if you take a hard, if you step back and you take a look at John McCain, he went to Annapolis. He had a career as a United States naval aviator, and he served in Vietnam and in prison. He's been a decent as senator for Arizona.
Now, you're a former congressman from Arizona. Are you formally backing John McCain for president?
I was a United States a member of the House of Representatives from California, from the Los Angeles area. And really, I didn't know John McCain. In fact, I got out of Congress when he was going in. So I didn't really know John McCain, and I can't say that I really know him today.
You look a lot like your father, by the way. I guess it's not the first time you've been told that.
And, he looks like me.
But your glasses have narrower rims.
Yes.
Hillary Clinton started political life as what they called a Goldwater girl in 1964. And she visited him before his death when she was First Lady. I only saw some passing references to Hillary Clinton in the book. Did he have much of an opinion that he expressed about her in the 90s?
What's interesting about still in the McCain context, in the senator's senior years, the politicians who were paying most attention to him out of Washington, believe it or not, are the Clintons. Not John McCain, because of Goldwater's position on the issue of gays in the military. When Clinton tried to get that issue through the Congress and with the blessings of the Congress, Senator Goldwater, who was in retirement, stepped forward and said, "Listen, the issue is not whether they're straight or not in the military; it's whether they can shoot straight." Famously typical Goldwater line.
Famous quote.
And indeed went on Larry King and said, listen, and told his colleagues in Washington, back off on this president. He's got a lot of problems. Don't start beating up on him. And this starts a rapport, and I think it was Hillary's 40th birthday. Bill Clinton called Senator Goldwater and said, listen, Hillary was enticed into interest in politics because she was a Goldwater girl and was interested in your first 64 campaign. We're having a surprise party for her at the White House. She would be tickled if she had a call from you, and which he did. And that started a relationship between the Clintons and the senator. And so Bill Clinton visits Barry Goldwater on a number of occasions when he's hospitalized. And as you mentioned, Hillary Clinton would come with a surprise visit, as much as you can be a surprise visit when you have an entourage of Secret Service agents in his later years. And, much more attention than John McCain was giving him.
And I did notice that Goldwater had a reference in one of the writings in the book to Whitewater, and that the Republicans should ease up on all that stuff because it seemed like no big deal to him. Do you remember that, Barry Goldwater?
You know, I recall my father being a little critical of the Republican Party, and I think at one point in time he said, "You know, you ought to shut up and let the man govern." And some of the Republicans didn't care for that too much. But my father was a pretty straight talker, and he believed that they were picking on him and not really giving him a chance to get settled into the presidency.
I've got to give you a great story about that the senator shared with me in a conversation about that time when Barry was alluding to the fact that he was a little annoyed with the Republicans. In fact, in 92, there's a woman running in the 6th District, and there's also a fellow from Washington by the name of Doug Weed who's running in the 6th District who calls himself a Goldwater conservative. Well, the senator solved that by endorsing Karen English, who was the Democratic candidate. Huh. And after that, the the Arizona Republican powers that be came out to see him at his house and said, "Listen, Senator, you've got to stop this kind of activity. You know, we built this big building in downtown Phoenix for you, where it's Barry M. Goldwater Republican headquarters. And if you keep doing what you're doing, we're going to take your name off the building." And the senator said, "Well, if you keep doing what you're doing, I hope you will take my name off the building.
I'm going to take my name off the building." And how did that resolve?
They stopped talking to him about his activities.
The book is Pure Goldwater. These are writings, 50 years worth of writings of Barry Goldwater, collected in a book now by John Dean and Barry Goldwater Jr., his son, who also served in Congress from California in the House. And I noticed the passage where he criticizes the media during President Clinton's first year. He says the media were relentless in knocking George H.W. Bush during his reelection campaign against Clinton. Then they were so hard on Clinton as a first year president. So he saw the media not in left-right bias terms, but as an equal opportunity destroyer.
He did very much. Barry obviously remembers the 64 campaign because he was working for his father. I've talked to the senator about it over the years. You're right. He didn't characterize it as a partisan media, but just somebody who was really in their pursuit of the First Amendment right to be critical of public figures, sometimes crossing the line. In fact, he let most everything go after the 64 campaign, excepting when Ralph Ginsburg, who was a New York-based publisher, went after him in the most vicious and nasty way, declaring that he was psychologically unfit to be president. And I was, by the grace of a New York lawyer, Stanley Arkin, able to find the original transcript of that trial, which has been buried all these years. And this is pure Goldwater under oath.
Oh, this was a libel or slander case?
It was a defamation case, yeah. And not long after New York Times versus Sullivan, where it's very difficult for a public official like Goldwater to bring a lawsuit. But he made the decision that if those who are running for president can be subject to this kind of wide-open attack and can't recover, and he wasn't looking for money. He was looking for a precedent that would give people who were running for the highest office or any high office some rights and powers to strike back. And he prevailed in that lawsuit.
Barry, did you hear your father complain about the media a lot?
Not a lot. He got along with them relatively well, but I think in Pure Goldwater, the book that we put together of his journals, he talks about the media and how unintelligent they are, that they really don't know too much about what they're reporting on. They have a left-wing Eastern established bias.
So he did get into bias.
Yeah, he did. He definitely talked about that, especially back in his memoirs. He refers to certain specific reporters that had
Drew Pearson was one of his favorites, critically favorites.
For example?
Well, he just said that he felt that these people had been so long reporting on the New Deal and New Deal politics that they couldn't understand somebody with the positions that he had, where maybe the government can't solve every problem. And so they were immediately suspect and suspicious of a senator who came from the West, where he'd individualism was still important. And they were very, you know, they did a pretty good job of trying to attack him. In fact, he famously said during the 64 campaign, after reading the media coverage of him, "I wouldn't vote for the guy that the media is covering in the in this race."
Right, the Barry Goldwater who they're portraying. And probably central as anything to his legacy was that he was kind of a sworn enemy of the New Deal. Did he want to undo everything FDR did, Barry?
It wasn't so much undo as change the conversation and the agenda that the New Deal created. It created a mentality that somehow or another that work and self-sufficiency was no longer a valid quality in this country. That this country was founded by the Constitution on freedom. And my father worked his whole life to to support and defend freedom.
But he equated freedom with not having a social safety net?
He equated freedom with individualism. And in other words, self-sufficiency and hard work, getting off your duff and go to work and take care of yourself. He was not opposed to a social safety net for those who really needed it.
The sequence seems to be, in my look at his material, it's first the individual's got to do the best he can. If he can't, then state and local government certainly has a role in fostering and creating an atmosphere in which that individual can work. Charity, when people are in trouble, should be the first to step forward, and he's very active in Phoenix Charities. In fact, we cite some of his thinking in one of the speeches he gave to try to encourage locals to get involved. But he thought indeed as a last safety net that when none of those serve and work, that indeed the government does have a role. So he's not opposed to the New Deal in a philosophical sense that everything that was there was bad, because he just thought we have to stop this at some point, and we can't continue to grow it till we get into a socialist world. And so that's what he's trying to counterbalance.
Would he have abolished Social Security?
No, I don't think he would have.
No. In fact, in the book, he talks about Social Security, that he would make sure that it worked and was profitable. I think he would have supported individual plans that had been proposed as a way of solving.
Mm-hmm.
He was concerned about the growing entitlement programs that could very well bankrupt this country. And certainly another point to make about his thinking was that he believed that the power of our government stems from the people up through the states and then to the federal government, and not the other way around. And so a lot of this social network of programs should really be at the local level and not dictated to by Washington, D.C.
We'll continue in a minute with John Dean and Barry Goldwater, Jr. They have put together a collection of the journal entries of Barry Goldwater, the former senator and 1964 Republican presidential nominee. Among other things, when we continue, we'll talk about why, even though he was pretty easy on Bill Clinton, he was pretty tough on Jimmy Carter, why you both think that he still matters to politics today, and we can take some phone calls for John Dean or Barry Goldwater Jr., 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Got a video you think should be included in our weekly online video picks? Send the link to Brian Lehrer Show at WNYC.org. Put the word video in the subject line. This week's picks include an engineer's homage to his three cats. See our online video picks, and it's a very engineer's homage to his three cats. See our video picks at WNYC.org. Click on video. And we're talking to John Dean and Barry Goldwater Jr. right now about the collection of writings of the late Senator Barry Goldwater, collected under the book title Pure Goldwater. Our lines are open at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You published tributes to Goldwater after his death by colleagues in the Senate, including liberal Democrat Paul Wellstone, probably the most liberal senator at that time,
who had also written a book called The Conscience of a Liberal, which is, the flip side of Goldwater's classic, The Conscience of a Conservative.
And you later wrote a book called Conservatives Without Conscience.
Which I was going to do with the senator originally.
Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. He and I, that's how we discovered the journal. What happened is I was talking to the senator, and he was talking about his unhappiness with the incivility that had crept into the conservative movement. He was also unhappy that the religious right was running the Republican Party. He said, John, I'd like to understand this. And he said, this would be a good project for us to undertake. And what you might do is start with some of the notes I've gathered in my files. They're down there at the Arizona Historical Foundation. Well, the senator's health turned bad, and as I told Barry, I said, you know, I think there's going to be a burden on your father, so let's wait till he feels better, then we'll resume the project. That didn't happen, but I didn't drop the project. And so the first thing I did when I started on a book called Conservatives Without Conscience, which incidentally came from a conversation with him where he said, I think conservatism has lost its conscience. Huh. I said, Senator, that's a great title, and that's what we'll title this book.
So he's slated as a man of integrity by Paul Wellstone, also heralded there by Strom Thurmond. That's a wide swath of respect for one politician to cut. And Thurmond, of course, is best known as a segregationist in his day, and Goldwater's run for president came in the same year as the landmark Civil Rights Act. Barry Goldwater, Jr., did your father support or oppose that law?
The Civil
Rights Act of 1964.
Well, my father was a member of the NAACP in Arizona.
Is that right?
Yeah, and when he was in the city council, he integrated the theaters, the airport, and later on, the Air National Guard. He was way ahead of his time in terms of equal rights. And he says in the journals that we published under Pierre Goldwater that from his father he got this this advice that all men were created equal, and you should always treat people with kindness and generosity and take care of your neighbors. He was full of that, and his life was full of giving. When he was in the United States Senate, he voted many times for civil rights legislation, but when it came down to the 64 Civil Rights Act, I think John has a better grasp of his rationale for the vote that he cast.
I was actually in the gallery. I was in law school at the time and went up to see that vote on the public accommodation section. And I asked him after, this is the one civil rights bill he votes against. And I later asked him, Senator, why did you vote against the 1964 public accommodation section? He said, well, I had advice from two lawyers who came to me with very powerful cases that this was unconstitutional. One was a young guy from Phoenix who clerked on the Supreme Court for Robert Jackson, who I thought was a pretty good justice, a fellow by the name of Bill Rehnquist. And he said the other guy who came to me was a fellow by the name of Robert Bork, who was a professor up at Yale. And he said they made a very powerful case. As we all know, Bill Rehnquist would later end up on the Supreme Court, and Bork would not quite make the cut. But he, I think, later, when the court did rule, realized he'd gotten some bad legal advice.
And Mr. Goldwater, I know you have to go. Thank you for coming in. We'll continue with John Dean. In fact, we have a caller on this point who remembers Goldwater particularly in respect to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and it's Arturo in Manhattan. Hi, Arturo.
Yes, I happen to be old enough, and as a child growing up in the city in New York, where Goldwater was perhaps the most hated man in this country. And one of the reasons is because he was a self-hating Jew, and it was in his best interest.
Not true.
It was true.
Well, let me tell you why it's not true.
Wait. Okay, let me just be clear on what you called to talk about, because you told my screener, why did Goldwater hate blacks and try to change the Civil Rights Act?
And so revisionist history is it today where the liberals and the yuppies want to try and make him some kind of icon. I'll hang up.
Well, let me explain what he did in 1965 when he brought the lawsuit. One of the things that Ralph Ginsberg had said in trying to defame him in the 64 race was that he was a self-hating Jew, that he didn't recognize his Jewishness, that he had tried to run from it, and exactly the opposite is the case. And they put on in that trial, and you'll find in this book, exactly the opposite. Here's a man who was proud of the fact that his father was a Jew, his mother was not, so he was half-Jewish, and that he was raised in his mother's church, not his father's.
Episcopalian church.
But he always took great pride in being a Jew. And indeed, one of the things when he ran for president, he said to a lot of people, he said, you know, the United States will never elect a Jew to be president. But in fact, he didn't want to run for president and when Kennedy was assassinated, but that's another story. Anyway, in court, under oath, and well corroborated, he makes the case that he certainly was never a anti-Semitic. He was never anything but proud of his Jewish heritage. So the caller has, as many people, have this man wrong. And that's one of the reasons we thought this book was important.
John, you're best known for your role as President Nixon's White House counsel and breaking ranks on Watergate, and more recently for your books like Conservatives Without Conscience. He broke ranks with Nixon eventually, and the book seems to recount a time when he was hoping to be appointed ambassador to Mexico, and that was in the works. Tell us that story.
Yeah, that was really quite remarkable. One of the things that was very surprising in finding this material in the journal is that the bulk of it, the greatest amount of it, it relates to Nixon and Watergate. And one of the things that was a true revelation to me is during the height of Watergate, while Goldwater has always been interested because of his association with Mexico and being the ambassador to Mexico, he talks about not running in 1974. And he tells this to Nixon, and Nixon says, well, what would you like? And Barry says, well, nothing. And then he says, oh, come on, Barry, there must be something we can do for you. And this is, of course, at the height of Watergate. So what he does is he sees the right moment, and he tells Nixon, he said, I'd like to be ambassador. So Nixon says, it's yours. Showing the man's integrity when it became very clear to him, and he really didn't understand Watergate until its later stages when Ben Bradlee, of all people, of the Washington Post, tells him how bad it really is, he withdraws his defense of Nixon. And there's one letter we put in the book where he has gone, rather than dictate to a secretary, he's gone to his portable typewriter and sent a personal letter to Nixon saying, hey, it's about time to start acting like you're a president. He said, maybe I should be writing this rather than, dear Mr. President, dear Dick, you and I have known each other a long time. You're not being forthcoming. You're not telling the American people what they need to know, and you're in a whole heap of trouble. So he didn't let the fact that this plum that he very much wanted influence his behavior, and he would eventually, because of his colleagues pushing, be urged to go down and tell the president he'd bought the farm and it was time to leave.
Before we leave the question of Goldwater and ethnic minorities aside, he's hard on Jimmy Carter in a journal entry from just after Carter was elected in 1976. And he said Carter had run a dishonest campaign and used the old FDR model of, quote, organizing the minorities, unquote, and promising them everything you can promise them. Is there a tinge of racism in that? I mean, as if America's minorities had such electoral power in 1976.
Well, I've never seen a tinge of racism in Goldwater at all. In fact, I know so many civil rights leaders who have come forward over the years and said, particularly after his 64 vote against the public accommodation section, said, this man is not a racist. It's just his principles believe that this is something the federal government shouldn't do. We disagree with him, and ultimately the court would disagree with him, but it wasn't the racist issue that influenced him. It was rather what we were doing to our Constitution that concerned him. His biggest beef with Carter was actually what he was doing in the Panama Canal, and he didn't think a president should unilaterally abrogate a treaty, and he would indeed take Carter to court. We didn't deal with a lot of that in the book, but of course that was a famous case, and it shows the changing relationship between the Congress, the courts, and the presidency, where indeed he was unable to pursue that lawsuit because they thought that was a political question that really should be resolved between the two political bodies.
From our comments page, some say that the Democratic electoral counterpart to Senator Goldwater was George McGovern. Did the two have any sort of relationship?
They were remarkably close. In fact, they were best of friends. George McGovern was a B-1 bomber, I believe it was, during the World War II. They both flew planes. Hubert Humphrey was another close friend. But all these men in that era could go out and have heated debates on the Senate floor and then walk off and have a drink together and be the best of friends and enjoy each other's company. George McGovern and Barry Goldwater were very close. I've known George McGovern over the years. In fact, have interviewed him a number of times and thought, you know, it's a shame that people don't see people the way one gets to know them, because George McGovern was truly presidential timbre. He's a fine man, and I think it was the country's loss. I think it was the country's loss that Goldwater never became a president, even in a later time.
Do you think that they ever shared a laugh about how if they added up their electoral votes, they still wouldn't have been elected?
I'm sure they did. But he knew that going in. Goldwater had planned to run against Kennedy. When Kennedy was assassinated, in fact, we put in the book what they had planned to do, which was to travel the country in an airplane and have Lincoln-Douglas-type debates. It might have changed presidential campaigning.
Kennedy was willing? Was known?
Kennedy not only was willing, was telling his family that we're going to do this. In fact, we quote Robert Kennedy Jr., who remembers his uncle, talking about how he and Barry Goldwater were going to travel the country and campaign through these types of debates.
Well, the Democratic presidential hopefuls just had 21 of them.
Well, they've done it in excess, and they've that's one another thing that the senator was very opposed to and was very prescient in a way of the influence of money and special interests are having in American politics and democracy. His recommendation was to shorten the election period because of the First Amendment problems, although he thought that Buckley versus Viejo, the famous First Amendment case that has opened up and restricted federal regulation, if that couldn't be tailored and narrowed, that we should amend the Constitution because it is so poisoning democracy that every vote isn't really equal because the rich man has a much more powerful vote than the normal citizen.
But wouldn't Goldwater, as a libertarian, not have wanted to restrict the flow of money into politics and just considered it kind of the natural order of things, that richer people would spend more than poorer people?
Not really. He thought it was so damaging to democracy that that other money was coming in that his libertarian streak did not take him that far.
By the way, on the idea of that as a Lincoln-Douglas debate model, what he was going to do with Kennedy and the 21 that the Democrats have just had, I know Newt Gingrich says the problem with the debates is the celebrity moderators from the network.
That's a very good question. When we get down to whether it's an issue as to somebody wearing an American flag lapel pin, and we go on at great length about that, it's pretty sorry.
So in our last minute, in the preface to the book, you write that Barry Goldwater still matters because of the polarization in American politics today. Why cite that?
One of the things that's one of the many things I said as the relevance. It's his political style, the fact he didn't believe in divisive politics. He always ran on the high road, refused to get in the gutter and go negative even when his opponents went against him. We think he is not only iconic, but he's exemplary. He's not perfect, but he took what he saw as 19th century basics, brought them into the 20th century. We think politicians in the 21st century should not forget these.
John Dean, along with Barry Goldwater Jr., he has put together a collection of 50 years of journal entries and other writers of the late Senator Barry Goldwater called Pure Goldwater. Who's your publisher?
Paul Grave Macmillan.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Yes.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up in a minute, what if Rupert Murdoch bought Newsday and Michael Bloomberg bought the New York Times? Could happen.